Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you now at 1-800-462-7413. As always, along with your calls, some topics to talk about. Tell us, Zorba.
Yes. Should we introduce certain foods such as peanuts and eggs early to young babies to actually keep them from becoming allergic? A change in the stance of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And very interesting research on aspirin and how it might just lower the risk of getting malignant melanoma.
Well, is there anything aspirin doesn't do?
It doesn't pay the bills at home. That's all it does.
I should have been taking an aspirin a day while I was going to school. It would have helped my brain.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. There's no doubt, Tom.
What's our recipe?
Orange juice oatmeal. It's a variation, obviously, on what your mom used to make, and it is really good.
This one comes from a listener in West Lafayette, Indiana, and you'll hear about that later on in the hour. Again, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. To the phones now, Zorba, as we welcome a listener from Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I had a question for Zorba about exercise and tailbone pain. I don't know how, but somehow I injured my tailbone. And over the last year, I've graduated from college and been trying to get back in shape now that I got some free time. And I talked to my local doctor, and he suspected that I either bruised or broke my tailbone, and I needed to basically just wait for it to heal on its own without re-injuring it. And I was wondering if you had any recommendation for abdominal exercise or even exercise in general, how to avoid re-injuring that tailbone.
Right. Tailbone pain can really be very problematic. I want to go back. There's no injury that you know of that did it.
No, not that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't remember falling on the ice or anything like that.
But we remember injuries. You know, if we fall on the ice or we slip or we fall, we go, boing, I've got tailbone pain. It started with this. You know, you'd remember an injury that's like that. Let's talk about your chairs. What kind of a chair do you sit on?
At home, I have a fairly plush desk chair.
Okay.
And then I also have a kind of hard futon, and I almost wonder if that's aggravating it.
Well, you want to look. One of the things you want to do with tailbone pain, and tailbone pain is a problem. I have a patient I've had for many, many years, and when he was in high school, one of the kids pulled a chair out from under him. You know, you remember that in high school, he fell.
Yeah.
You know, he was sitting in high school. He did it all the time. Everyone laughed. Landed on his tailbone, and he has had pain for 10 years. You know, from that inconsequential injury. We have x-rayed it, we have CT scanned it, we have done MRI scanning, and we can't find any reason for the tailbone pain, but clearly there is inflammation around the tailbone. He's had injections into the tailbone several times. He's done a variety of things with it, and it's very problematic. But I have done a lot of research on this because I had this patient, and I have a few recommendations. First of all, the idea that the futon may be the issue may indeed be the issue. You've got to look at every time you're actually pushing on it. So you've got to look at the chairs. They've got to be soft. Some people actually get a donut, it's called, and you can picture it. It looks like a rubber donut or an inner tube that you get when you're going to the beach, and they sit on it so they don't put direct pressure on the tailbone. Kitchen chairs are notorious for this. Desk chairs are notorious for this. I would recommend you look at cushions. That's the most important thing. That is number one, number two, and number three for this. Now, for exact exercises, there's no exercise that you can do for the tailbone. However, there are exercises that you can do for the buttocks to build up your butt. Now, most people don't want to build up their butt. They want to, especially women, they want to tone down their butt. But you actually want to tone up your butt. And there are exercises that you can do. You can find out from a trainer. There's some very good machines. I go to a gym, work out in a machine, and I actually use one of the machines that actually improves my buttock muscle because I use my buttock muscle when I'm skiing. And the other place I would look at is a physical therapist. Physical therapists are great for looking at stretching exercises that are good for things such as buttocks. And I would definitely look for it to see if there's some buttock things. And if you go to our website, zorbapastor.org, on there I'll have some suggestions of what you can do. And I'll go through YouTube and some other places to try to find some buttock exercises for you.
Okay. I'll definitely give it a try.
Thank you for your call. Thanks for listening.
We appreciate it. I never thought about exercising your butt.
Of course. Of course. You never thought about butt exercise? Don't you want to tone up your butt for Monica?
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, a listener joins us in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I took an injury to my knee about 3 weeks ago, and they said it was not broken, but that I have sprained the tendon. And I'm wondering, as one of those natural people, if there is another option besides taking an anti-inflammatory that would do just as well.
Uh-huh. So tell me a little bit about what's going on with your knee in terms of function, dysfunction, when the pain comes.
Well, I can actually walk now without crutches or my brace.
Good.
It is improving.
Mm-hmm.
But you know how you can bear down and walk and know that you're not 100% yet.
Right.
So,
right. That's an
important
point.
Of course, I want to see the healing. I just don't want to do it with any pain meds or anti-inflammatories.
Well, let's talk about a few things, you know, for that. First of all, if we look at natural anti-inflammatories, number one is the body. The body heals itself, you know, so you don't have to do anything often for many things, and the body will just get better. It may take a little bit longer, but it will be done in a very natural way. If we look at anti-inflammatories, glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate do work for some people. And it is a more natural product, but of course it's still a manufactured product. So, but it is more natural, I would say. Glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, you know, it certainly is not a mainline pharmaceutical anti-inflammatory. That's a possibility. Another possibility are there are anti-inflammatory gels if you don't want to actually take a pill. And diclofenac gel, the name is Voltaren, V as in Victor, Voltaren. Voltaren gel, and I don't remember the specific trade name for it, has been used for many, many years in Canada, got approved in the U.S. a few years ago, and it has been shown to really work on the joint. You don't have to actually take a pill. And those are really the possibilities. The other thing, of course, is physical therapy. Massage to the joint. There are a number of massage therapists that tell me that when they massage a joint, they can get rid of the inflammation too. Those are all the things.
I see. Very good. And I've even heard of some anti-inflammatory foods.
Well, there are a number of books that are written on the anti-inflammatory foods, and I have not been impressed with any of the research. And I'm going to get on my soapbox now, although, frankly, I haven't seen a soapbox itself in probably about 45 or 50 years. Anyway, getting on the bandwagon soapbox, a lot of books that talk about anti-inflammatory foods use quasi-science. And quasi-science is, well, this study showed it, and therefore it is the case. Well, you know, science is science. One study doesn't mean anything. There are good studies and bad studies. There are good science and junk science. And frankly, when we look at anti-inflammatory foods and people who have written about them, I think basically they write about them to get lecture fees and sell their books. I have not been impressed that actual foods actually have anti-inflammatory properties. But as I said, the body heals itself.
Thank you. So seriously, if I'm getting better each day and just kind of treat it gingerly, I should be fine.
You betcha. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Why soapbox? Everything used to come in boxes. Was the soapbox just
no
about the
idea.
Right height to stand on?
I have no idea. You know something? We'll have to Google it and look it up. I have no idea. But they obviously came in wooden boxes.
Yeah.
Because you would never stand on a cardboard box.
Well, of course not.
That
but
had
other
soap
things
in it.
Must have come in wooden
yeah,
boxes.
Yeah. Why not a fruit crate? Yeah. Why don't you get up on your fruit crate and say what you want to say? They must have been stronger boxes, don't you think?
Than other things. Probably so.
Exactly. Exactly.
Before our next call, Zorba, you have some interesting research to talk about, suggesting that there may be a way to help babies stave off allergies.
That's right. Well, first of all, I want to go back a bit. I'm going to go back a little bit. The American Academy of Pediatrics in 2000 said, wait a minute, guys. When you have a baby, don't introduce milk, whole milk, before the age of 12 months. You don't want to introduce eggs before they're 2 years of age. You don't want to introduce peanuts and fish until they're 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with that.
Yeah.
Well, they were wrong. That's what they said. They said, guess what? We're wrong. And they're reversing things completely. They, along with the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, said, wait a minute. What we really should be doing is introducing milk and eggs and peanuts and fish earlier. They shouldn't be the first solid foods that kids get at 6 months. But basically, we may be introducing them too late so that the body is now setting up an immune response to them, and we now have a food allergy because we're holding off on these particular.
So how early is early enough?
Basically, after the baby is 6 months old and we start to introduce solid foods, their recommendation now is begin to introduce milk, whole milk, begin to introduce eggs, begin to introduce peanuts and fish. So we're talking about 6 months, 8 months, somewhere in that
range. Isn't any danger if the baby is likely to be allergic to introducing this?
If you come from a highly allergic family and everyone in your family or lots of people in your family are allergic to peanuts, if the baby has eczema, that's kind of a different situation. Then you have to sit down on a child-by-child basis. But overall, they're reversing what they recommended. Now, this is quite interesting. When I started practice back in the dark ages, 1200, 1300 AD.
Yeah.
But really, when I started practice, we introduced eggs during the first week of life in order to try to get babies interested in eggs. It was very interesting. And then then there was a complete hue and cry.
It's funny how that stuff goes.
Totally. Totally. And that was a throwback. I remember it from the 50s. The idea was in the 50s, introduce eggs right away so they don't become allergic. And then in the year 2000, they said, don't introduce it until they're two or three because they'll become allergic. Now we're saying, well, go back to 6 months of age. And it reminds me of my old mentor, an iconoclast by the name of Dr. Bob Mendelsohn. When he was on the radio, and he was on the radio numerous times, he just had these strange, some of them I would say were rather goofy ideas. However, one idea that he had that he would always say, one grandmother is worth two doctors.
Got it. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller, is a listener in Niagara Falls, Canada. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Thanks for calling across the border. How can we help?
Well, I have a skin condition, rosacea. I've had it for 10 years. I've used prescribed medications as well as home remedies. And I was hoping, Zorba, that you might know of a treatment that has been successful for others.
Oh, sure. Have you used anything on your rosacea?
Do you mean in terms of creams or?
Creams or pills,
yes.
Anything?
Well, prescribed medication was metronidazole.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I found that whenever I used that, it would just flare up even more, like I was in constant breakout.
Okay.
So then human nature, I stop using it and move on to something else.
Yes.
And chamomile tea, barrage oil of oregano.
Right. All of the natural remedies, which, by the way, sometimes definitely work for people with mild rosacea. In other words, natural remedies can do it. Have you taken any pills at any time, any antibiotics at all?
No.
Okay. I've got a couple of suggestions. First of all, the remedies, the naturopathic remedies, homeopathic remedies, and creams can work when people have a mild condition. You don't have one, and they can work really, really well. People also find that certain foods can flare their rosacea. Things such as hot, spicy foods can actually flare it. Some people find that alcohol can flare it. And if you go to our website, zorbapastor.org, we'll give you a link to an number of foods and things that can actually flare and make rosacea worse. We'll put that information on our website. Now, one thing that really does work for many, many people with rosacea to get it under control is to sort of use antibiotics for 4 to 6 weeks. Some people even take them longer to get it under control. Doxycycline. And minocycline, M-I-N-O, cycline, C-Y-C-L-I-N-E, they're all tetracyclines, can really, really work. And you've got to take the pills for a while. Some people actually take them intermittently for years. They appear to be safe. We are always worried about antibiotics, but this particular antibiotic has been around for 50 years. It's been used for rosacea for a good 30 years. Highly effective. And what I would do if it were me is I would take the antibiotic for 4 to 6 weeks. Then I would reintroduce the Metrogel, which you're talking about, metrodinazole gel, which is also called Metrogel. It comes in a cream form and an ointment form. Some people tolerate the cream. Some people tolerate the ointment. And I would reintroduce that after I took the antibiotic just to get it under control. Then if it works, then I'd go back to the natural remedies. Sort of a step approach. Oral pill first, topical antibiotic second, natural remedy third, once it gets under control.
Okay, that sounds great.
I know. It must be very, very difficult. It's very hard when you've got a red face. People ask you what's wrong, or they look at you, and you can tell with your eyes that what they're thinking, right?
I've been asked that many times. What's wrong with your nose, Sue?
Right. You know, and they're just being nice. They're just asking.
Nice.
What is your response?
Very direct. Very concerned.
Very concerned. People are very concerned. They want to know if there's anything they can do to help you.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
There you go.
You don't say rosacea is my excuse. What's yours for having an ugly face?
You know, that would be rather insulting, Tom. People are just being nice to you.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413.
Rosacea is my excuse. What's your excuse?
Anyway, 800-462-7413. And on we go, Zorba, to a listener in Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I was diagnosed about 4 months ago with anemia during a routine blood test. I'm still taking iron supplements, 28 milligrams, 3 times a day, and I have a few questions.
Sure.
One, will my iron levels stabilize to a point where I will no longer have to take a supplement? 2, do the iron supplements do any damage to any other organs? And 3, should I be concerned with trying to find the cause of the anemia?
Well, let's start with number 3. The answer is you always have to be concerned with the cause of anemia. So did your doctor do blood tests and determine it was an iron deficiency anemia?
Yes.
Okay, so I mean that's a very important thing. So the first thing we want to find out if we have an iron deficiency anemia is where's the bleeding coming from? Because in America today, iron deficiency anemia based on nutrition is minimal. So we have to go back and look at the possibilities. First possibility, are you still menstruating?
Yes, and she just verbally asked me if I had heavy flow, which I said yes, and she prescribed Lystetta, but I didn't take it because it doesn't seem to be that big of a problem for me, and the side effects, when I read about it online, seemed to outweigh the benefits.
Right, and you didn't need to have a drug to actually do that. So what you so the possibilities and the cause is very important is high menstrual flow, a polyp or something lurking in the colon or something within the gullet, if you will, within the stomach itself. So you've got to kind of think with your doctor, well, do I need a colonoscopy? I'm going to get it at the age of 50, but maybe I should have it now. And there's no assurance here. Even though you have a heavy flow, you can't give assurance that there isn't something going on in the colon. That can be the first sign of colon problems. So I just want to mention that. You got to sit down with your doc, decide if you're going to get it. Cause is the most important thing here. Now, let's go to iron supplements. Usually people take iron supplements, they load up their body and they're better, and they usually take 325 milligrams a day, which is an iron pill, the doc checks if the iron is up to a normal level, then they stop taking that. And because it's usually from a cause, not a continuous cause, such as a heavy flow, but we'll say a polyp in the colon that is then removed. So you're probably not going to take it forever. But I think you've got to figure out whether this is from menstruation or something in your colon. I think that's critical.
Okay.
Okay, good luck.
Okay.
Let us know what happens, please.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We appreciate that call. And before the break, Zorba, time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. During a recent recipe, you mentioned that shallots were basically identical to green onions. What a mistake.
Blasphemy.
There was an instant influx of emails flooding our inbox from listeners outraged at your culinary confusion. Harry broke the news a little nicer than most. He wrote, "Hi, guys. Today you stated that shallots were just a fancy name for green onions. Wrong. A shallot is a small, mild onion, often used in French cooking, which has a bit of a garlic flavor. Scallions and green onions are the ones that are synonymous.
Oh.
Thanks for all of your good work."
Scallions and green onions. I stand corrected again. It's another example of a dietary foible that has somehow come into my brain. You know, that's... I stand corrected.
Right after the show, with that recipe, I went home. My wife said, "I just got a call from a friend. You know that Zorba thinks that scallions..." You can give all the good advice for months and months, and this is what people react to. Okay.
There you go.
Think you know your onions? Then send your show corrections along in an email to...
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a really good recipe, I think. I've not tasted it, but it's got all the stuff I like, and it's so easy to make, even I could do it. That's coming up. More of your calls. Another medical topic to talk over, our medical myth buster, too. Hey, you're going to want to stay with us for all that here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, as you know, before our next call, recipe time. And for our recipe this time, we are happy to welcome from West Lafayette, Indiana, a listener to the program, Dick Nelson. Dick, hi.
Hi.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
This one is for orange juice oatmeal.
Yes.
How interesting. How'd you come about this recipe?
Well, I spotted it in the local newspaper several years ago, and I thought it sounded so weird because it's a no-cook oatmeal recipe. I just had to try it, and it turned out that we liked it and tried it several times, then put it aside and couldn't locate it. But I thought that it might be of interest to your listeners.
Of course it is. Wait a minute. You put it aside and couldn't locate it? In other words, you stopped making it?
Stopped making it for a while.
Uh-huh.
You know, you get into these phases where something sounds interesting and then you go on to other things.
Yeah, because your mind just wanders. I do that all the time. I still remember when I was a kid, I would have an Oscar Mayer bologna sandwich on white bread with mustard and one piece of lettuce, not two. And I ate that for like 2 years. And then I couldn't stand Oscar Mayer bologna after that for a time. So I don't know what that is. So this is a
no-cook. You're not comparing this recipe to Oscar Mayer.
I am not comparing
white
it.
Bread.
I am not comparing this recipe. No offense taken. But I liked it when I was a kid. But anyway, so there's no, you can make this ahead and you set it out so you don't have to do it in the morning, right?
Right. It saves time in the morning.
Good. It's incredibly simple. I love it. So, all right, let's make the recipe, and I want to discuss some of these simple things. This is something, you know, our listeners, when we have more than like five ingredients, I've had people say, you know, how do you expect me to write it down? And then I think, well, I don't know, you're in the car, just stop the car and take
yeah,
a piece
right,
of paper and
right.
write it down. Okay, we start out with 3/4 cup of oatmeal. What kind of oatmeal do you use?
Definitely prefer the old-fashioned rather than the quick.
Old-fashioned. Okay, so old-fashioned makes us feel good, but it is. Okay, 1 cup of orange juice. What kind of orange juice do you like to use?
I usually use concentrate, from concentrate, but freshly squeezed would be even better.
Now, use from concentrate to save money, or you like the taste better?
Well, it has to be around for a while, and I think... I don't have to do the work every day.
I think that's logical. So a cup of orange juice, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice. When I use lemon juice, I like to use the frozen lemon juice that is then reconstituted. I use the Minute Maid brand, which I like better than real lemon. And, of course, if you have real lemon, that's wonderful. But only 1 tablespoonful squirt.
No, it's 1 teaspoon.
It's 1 teaspoon. Okay, so 1.
I think that might be a little too vigorous.
Okay, 1 teaspoon. Now, my wife loves lemon juice, and my wife puts vinegar on her salad. If I make this for her, I bet I'd use 1 tablespoonful.
Okay. Yeah.
And she would say, go for it. I love it. I love it. So we'll start.
I think I'd like a little more lemon.
A tablespoon. So, yeah. So you can do that. Half a cup of raisins. What kind of raisins do you use?
Just what we buy in the grocery store in a package.
Okay, so regular raisins. I might use golden raisins. I happen to like golden raisins.
Oh, I think
raisins.
That'd be good.
Yeah, I like golden raisins. I think they taste the same. I like they look. And 1/4 cup of almonds. What do you do with the almonds?
Would lightly brown those in the oven, and then I hold those over till the morning and do not add them.
You don't add them. So you toast the almonds in some fashion, putting
them
in the oven. How long do you put them in the oven for when you make them?
You know, it's about 2.25 minutes that I put it on broil.
Uh-huh. So you put it on broil, and you set the timer for 2.25 minutes.
Because it's so easy to burn the almonds.
So you've had experience with burning the almonds in this recipe.
We are quite qualified on that issue.
I understand what you're talking about. The broilers are good. Let's make it easy to make. Stir together oatmeal, orange juice, lemon juice, and raisins or other dried food. Cover and refrigerate it overnight. Okay. Lightly toast the almonds, of course, the night before if you want to, in a pan. Lightly toast them 2.25 minutes under broil. In the morning, stir it together again. Put the almonds right on top just before stirring, and bon appetit. This sounds great, and I find it so interesting because I don't consider orange juice. I don't think of orange juice with oatmeal in the same breath. It just doesn't. It's a taste I've never considered together.
I think I'd love this. I love the recipe. Listen, oatmeal, orange juice, lemon juice, raisins, almonds, end of story.
You know,
most of these recipes go on and on. Put this in, put that in, put the other thing in, flip it over, do some other. I love this.
And I don't pick recipes that have 14 ingredients.
Yeah, good for you.
I have to tell you, I have never seen Tom so excited about a recipe before. He just did a cartwheel. I kid you not, he just did a cartwheel in the studio. Well, a virtual cartwheel, not a real cartwheel. But he just loved this recipe. Thank you for sharing this with us. I am sure that our listeners are going to want to get a copy of this recipe.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed discussing it with you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dick Nelson, for joining us with that, I think, really yummy recipe. I'm going to do it. For sending us this winning recipe, Dick gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org. And if you want a copy of today's recipe, you can visit us at our website, zorbapastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly podcast, you can search all your favorite recipes, and you can see pictures of Tom and I cavorting in the studio. That's zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Back to the phones now, Zorba, at 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. And a listener with us now in Orange Park, Florida. Hi.
Hey, guys. I'm a 63-year-old man. I really enjoy your show. My wife does, too. And I've been trying to change the way I eat in order to be healthier because I come from a family with a history of heart disease. And I got my cholesterol down to 186 and HDL up to 48. But the triglycerides were still, you know, way up there in the ionosphere somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did some research and found out that sugar was one of the main problems with that. And my doctor told me, you know, no fruit juice. And so my question is, what about the fructose in raisins and cranberries and apples and things like that? Does that have the same effect as sucrose?
Fruits, fructose within fruits are totally different. So I want to go to this triglyceride thing, and then I'm going to give you a very specific recommendation. So first of all, triglycerides by themselves, I don't worry about them. Now, are they a risk factor? The answer is yes. But there is no study that has been shown that if we give a drug to lower triglycerides, that we actually reduce heart attacks and stroke. The one study that has been shown to be useful that you should look at is the Mediterranean diet study that recently came out. 7,500 people followed for 5 years. When they followed a Mediterranean diet, they had 30% fewer heart attacks and strokes than if they followed the traditional low-fat diet. In the Mediterranean diet, it's filled with fruits and vegetables. So my answer, the short answer to you is yes. If you're getting your fructose through fruits and vegetables, dynamite. If you're getting your fructose through high fructose corn syrup from sugary drinks, the answer is uh-uh.
Right.
That makes sense.
I had four stents put in my heart last Thursday. That's why more motivated to...
Highly motivated. Yeah. You come to our website, zorbapastor.org. We'll have a link to the Mediterranean diet. We'll also have a link to the study so that you can also look at this study. And that's what you need to do. You need to embrace, we all need to embrace a Mediterranean diet, and that will make us a much healthier society. Very important for you. The traditional medical low-fat diet is not as good as the Mediterranean diet.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
Good luck.
Show.
Good luck.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you so much for the call. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, we go to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Good day. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
I just had a quick question. I use a lot of fruits in the mornings. I make myself a shake for my breakfast. And to keep the fruit from going bad, I freeze it. I'm wondering if I'm losing any of the nutritional value by freezing it and then blending it with the other stuff that I put in my smoothies in the morning.
Uh-huh. How do you like your smoothies? What do you put in it? Some fruit?
I put four or five regular-sized strawberries, two handfuls of blueberries, a banana, a piece of fudge that my daughter always makes me, and some peanut butter.
Sounds perfect. You lose some nutritional value with freezing, but you also gain something. So, for example, if you look at fruits and veggies that have been in the store and they're sitting there for 4 or 5 days, they don't have the same nutritional impact as a strawberry that was frozen at the time that it was actually picked. So freezing really locks in a lot of value. Is it as good as fresh? A little bit less than fresh, but when I say fresh, I mean really fresh. I don't mean fresh that's been there for a few days. So yes, frozen food, great way to go. As you know, or as many people know, canning, which we basically are taking food and we're stabilizing it by heating. We lose vitamins every time we heat it up. But yeah, you use your frozen strawberries. I think it's a great idea. How's your height? How's your weight? I always think about smoothies. They have the imprimatur of being healthy because we put healthy things in, but they can be a caloric, you know, highly caloric drink.
I'm 5'7", and I weigh about 180 pounds. I'm not overweight, though. I mean, I've worn the same size clothes for 20 years. I just work out pretty good.
That's exactly it. And I want to bring up an important point with that. In BMI, we say, well, once you get above 25, you're in the obese range. And once you're above 30, you're in the morbidly obese range, unless you happen to be a Green Bay Packer player. But there are a lot of guys who have a BMI of 25, 26, 27, and they're not obese. They have muscle. And you can tell that because not just you necessarily look in the mirror and you use the Snow White test. How do I actually look in the mirror? But they actually can lift heavy things. In other words, they functionally have muscle. You know, so you can be at your height and your weight, 5'7", as you said, and you know, and the weight that you just mentioned. And you can be obese and you can be at 5'7", and that's my natural weight. And like you said, for 20 years you work out a lot, you're at the right weight. So,
well, I'm 51. I stay away from mirrors. They're not my friend anymore. I haven't had a cold or a flu in 10 or 15 years, and I tell everybody it's because of the fruits that I eat all the time.
May be right. You may be right. So thanks so much for your call.
No, thank you.
Sure. 800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pester on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Susan in Green Bay, Wisconsin, who needs a bit of your nutritional know-how. She says, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I wanted to know what you thought about belonging to a food co-op. I already shop at my local farmer's market, but now the nearby co-op is asking for new members. You're my go-to for information, Zorba. So what do you think? Is it worth the $180 fee?"
Well, that's a lot of money to join a co-op, $180 fee. You know, I guess as a consumer advocate, I have to question what this $180 fee would be. Now, for some, it means they're actually buying into, you know, the co-op that may own a building, so it costs $180. Mm-hmm. If you leave the co-op, do you get the $180 back? Mm-hmm. Is it $180 a year to join the co-op? Co-ops are great because you get together and often get food at a lower price. But frankly, I think you have to look at your food bill and then make some determinations about that. I love co-ops. I used to belong to co-ops. I don't belong to co-ops anymore because basically they're not convenient to where I live. Yeah. If they were, I would belong to one.
I'm not so much into doing things with other people.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. You are the solitary person. You are the non-co-op.
If you'd like to co-opt some of Zorba's advice, just send your questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another health topic that's coming up next. More of your calls, our medical myth buster too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, another benefit from taking aspirin, maybe?
Yes, absolutely. Very interesting. This is part of the Nurses' Health Study. It's a long-term study. There was the Physicians' Study, which was started, I think, decades ago. Mm-hmm. And the Nurses' Health Study, which was also started decades ago. The Nurses' Health Study were women. They were all women. Men were basically just a sub-study of it. And they looked specifically, analyzed Caucasian women. Mm-hmm. And the reason is Caucasian women in this particular analysis are much more likely to get melanoma.
Okay.
Black mole, it's the skin cancer that can kill you.
Okay.
And what they discovered, they looked at the women from the ages of roughly 50 to 70, followed them over a 12-year period. Again, it's part of a whole bunch of other things they followed, looked at who got melanoma and who did not. And lo and behold, if you took aspirin on a regular basis for at least 5 years, there was a 30% reduction in melanoma. That is huge.
Yeah. And this is a lot of women they looked at. So you would
60,000 women.
You would assume that some of them were in the sun a lot and others weren't.
Absolutely. 60,000 women. I mean, 60,000. Oh. And that's a lot of women. You would also assume that these are nurses who are going to use sunscreen if they're in the sun, some of them.
Yeah.
But these are 60,000 women. The reason why they chose nurses and doctors is they pay attention to their health. Yeah. They write down what they have. This is an enormous drop of melanoma.
This makes no sense. Why would an aspirin have any effect on skin
cancer? Well, we don't – you know what happens is aspirin is an amazing drug. Yeah. And we then go back and say, why would this have any effect on skin cancer? And when we go back, it may be the reduction of inflammation that does it. But we don't really know. We don't know what actually is it. We look at melanoma. It's on the rise. Yeah. And it's been on the rise for years.
Yeah. So we can't assume that if we take aspirin, we can get out in the sun and not have to worry about
Not at all. And, you know, there's a cause and effect issue. One of the problems with sunscreen, first of all, sunscreen is great. Find a sunscreen that works. Put it on before you go in the sun. I happen to like a spray. Some people like a liquid. But find one that's aesthetically pleasing. But you can't just take an aspirin and go out in the sun with sunscreen. And when you use sunscreen in the sun, you don't get vitamin D, which is why I've been recommending 1,000 to 2,000 units of D. But getting back to the aspirin, this is a massive difference. Yeah. Massive difference.
Well, here's my theory on skin cancer. I like being in the sun.
Okay.
I'm old. Okay. I'm going to die of something.
Okay. Why don't you die of melanoma? Because you just get in the sun, go in the sun.
I don't
want to.
I don't want to stay away from the sun.
You're a beach guy. You're right. We have to still be rational about being in the sun. I like that. I know. I do like to be in the sun. We also have to look at what people do. So, if you've got a family history of melanoma, take your aspirin every day. But don't forget, you still have to stay out of the sun, the bright sun in the middle of the day, and put on your sunscreen.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll-free. Ann Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I recently had an illness that lasted about 3.5 weeks, and this is probably the worst I've had. And the catch about that is it's lung-related, and I actually live above a smoker, so I'm getting a lot of secondhand smoke. So my question is, could the two be related? And then what are the risks of the continuous secondhand smoke from that?
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, let's talk about what probably happened. You probably got influenza. That would be the most very likely diagnosis. And influenza often lasts for weeks. It's awful. It's not the typical cold or sore throat. And there's no way to look back and find out if you actually did it, so we wouldn't know for sure. But pretty likely that that was the diagnosis. And for some people, it takes them 3 to 6 weeks to improve. You know, 20,000 influenza deaths every year within this country roughly are a lot of deaths. So
the cigarette smoke had...
Let's talk about the cigarette smoke. So you live above a smoker. What do you mean above a smoker?
I do. I live in an older house, and so it's shared ventilation. And so the smoke comes just straight up through my vent.
Wow.
It's every morning at about 6 a.m. and every night. So it's pretty bad. I've gotten an air filter, but it doesn't seem to help. And I do have sensitivities to that. And so my nose is always constantly running from that as well.
Sure. Well, we know secondhand smoke is bad for us. I mean, we know that. And that could have certainly prolonged your illness. You know, if the smoker gets up in the morning, smokes during the evening, and the ventilation goes up, you know, I mean, that's a difficult problem to solve.
You're a renter?
I am, yeah.
Okay. Is there anything that the landlord, can't you complain about it and have some fix for the ventilation system in your apartment?
Well, I did complain to the company that I was renting to, and then I contacted the landlady, and it seems like there was a glitch, and so the communication wasn't right on for it being a non-smoking property. So they talked to her, but it doesn't seem like it's really had much of an effect.
I'm going to ask a question. So you rented that as a non-smoking place?
I did, with the understanding that the woman in the other unit didn't smoke at all.
Well, the answer is, obviously, they misrepresented it. And so you have to say, hey, there's a smoker here in the house. What are you going to do to fix this? You know, that's ultimately it. So now, whether or not they'll actually fix it or not, I have no idea. I've dealt with rental units before, but I wouldn't let it pass. I would say, wait a minute, you said it's non-smoking and this person smokes. I have rights. I'm in a non-smoking property. I fully, you know, it used to be many, many years ago, and I, full disclosure, I was a smoker back in college, you know, and pretty much you would smoke everywhere. And of course, we used to smoke in restaurants, we'd smoke on airplanes, we'd smoke in cars with other people. We never thought about it. Society has changed. Mm-hmm. And basically, non-smokers have taken over and have the rights and say, wait a minute, I have the right to be in a non-smoking environment. You got to talk to your landlord. Now, you don't have to talk to this person, but you have to say, hey, I have a smoker. where the ventilation is going to go in my room. What are you going to do? Are you going to reduce my rent? Are you going to move me to another location? But yes, if you have smoking sensitivity and the ventilation is going right into your apartment, you got to get the landlord or landlady to fix it. You've got to tell them this is not acceptable. And tell them to call our show and we'll explain it why.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your
You
answer.
Are most welcome. Yeah. Good luck. Please let us know what happens.
Thank you so much. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time once again now for a medical myth buster. And today we have a listener myth from Wanda in Buffalo, New York, who needs your help clearing up a shopping stigma. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba Pastor, I enjoy your program and believe your answers are right on target. I've read several articles about the toxicity of the receipts we get in stores. Is there any truth to the claim that they might be harmful?"
You know, when we look at risk, we have to look at relative risk depending on everything else. Now,
is what we're talking about the germs that might be on the receipt?
No, we're talking about the chemicals.
Oh.
In other words, you've got chemicals in the paper. So if it's a lot of these papers are heat activated receipts, in other words, and they contain something called BPA. BPA is a chemical which might actually induce cancer in people who then consume BPA. It's not going to come in through your fingers. Your fingers are going to be okay. But if you then lick your fingers after you have a receipt, maybe you get some BPA on it. And in reality, it's I think the risk is so minuscule. I think the risk is less than you're getting struck by lightning. So I would take those heat receipts and I wouldn't be concerned, even though they may have a chemical. But come on, there are chemicals all over the place.
Well, if you are concerned, you can always kind of handle the receipt just on the edge without any.
No. You, even better. Put on those white gloves.
That'd work.
Put on those white gloves and handle the receipt. Or you could look really goofy and just put on plastic gloves. You're at the cash register and they hand you the receipt. You say, wait a second. Put on your plastic gloves. Well, maybe the plastic and the plastic gloves is also doing it. Don't be concerned about the receipts. There are more important things to think about in life.
Have a myth or purchase for which you need proof? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now another call, Zorba, a listener with us in Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba. This is Carl Miller in Wichita, Kansas.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Yep. In a recent show, you'd mentioned a study that indicated that walking outside would lead to longevity. I'm trying to lose weight, and my favorite exercise is walking. Do I have to power walk in that case, or just a good general quick walk? So I comfortably walk at 18, 20 mile minutes. Sometimes when I get bored, I jog a little bit and I break it down to 14, 15 mile minute, but I really don't like doing that. So do you have any recommendations?
You know, I think you're doing a good job. I mean, if you do a mile in 20 minutes, you're walking at a brisk pace. I mean, you're not just sort of lollygagging around the park as you're walking from park bench to park bench, right? I mean, that's dynamite. Let's look at what walking does. Walking is something that we can often do. That's the most important thing. Jogging, as your joints get older and you get older, you know, you're more likely to fall. You're more likely to injure your knee. I mean, jogging is sort of a young person's sport for many of us, not for all of us, but for many of us. The idea about walking is it doesn't really have to be power walking. Now, you get more benefit if you feel like you're pushing yourself. You get more aerobic benefit, no doubt about it. If you're sweating and you push yourself, you'll get more aerobic benefit. But you get benefit when you walk no matter what. And I think that's the most important thing. Americans sit around and they don't do much. You know, you look at the numbers, it could be 40%, 60%, 80%, but a huge number of people, certainly over the age of 40 or 50, don't do anything other. Their walking is from the refrigerator to the sofa. You know, that's basically the amount of walking that they get. How often do you walk, sir?
When it's nice out, I try to walk every day of the week. When it's inclement weather, I usually stay in.
Yeah, but that's kind of the way to do it. So I think you're doing a good job. Power walking means pushing yourself so you feel like you're doing some exercise. And if you're walking that mile in 20 minutes, you're right on key, right spot on.
Okay. Yeah, because I found you mentioned about sitting around. Well, I'm dust bound 8 to 10 hours a day. Plus mm-hmm. whatever I sit around at home, so
yeah, sure.
I do try to get out and get going a little
there
bit.
There you go. There you go. Exactly. Keep it up. Keep walking.
All right. Thanks for the advice.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. And Zorba, before we head out, it's time again for us to hear from another member of the infamous Grammar Police. And this week we have something rare to read, a compliment. And what's
Wait
more-
a minute. Wait a minute. I really wasn't listening to you. Did you say a compliment?
Yeah, but don't get a big head. This one's, this one's for me.
The police now. Oh, my heart is broken.
My heart is broken. I hesitate reading this because I don't want the focus to be ever on me.
Please, Tom.
The focus should always be on Zorba Pastor.
No.
Finally, I'm opening up a hornet's nest here by reading something nice about me. For the rest of this show, we're going to hear
for the
daggers
rest of the year.
At me.
For the rest of the year.
All right. I'll let Romel in Las Vegas do the flattering for me. She writes, I was listening to the show, and I just want to say thank you to Tom. The segment was coming up on a break, and Tom said, coming up, we have blah, 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 blah. My main point is that he said we have instead of we've got. It was refreshing to hear someone who actually speaks correctly, unlike many other hosts.
You mean
whom
you
I
mean
won't
what?
Name.
You mean what?
Whom I won't
like
name.
Many other
do
hosts?
Do you say we've got? Anyway, so thank you, Tom, she says. I, for one, appreciate hearing it. So that's it.
So my question to you is your compliment an insult to me? That's what I want to know.
I'm going
to take it on a personal basis. You know.
I guess that is kind of a grammar police criticism.
Come on, it's a criticism of me. What was it? That defines a backhanded criticism.
Anyway.
I mean, come on. On the other end, Tom, your grammar, I always think of it as pristine. Right. Impeccable.
That's what everybody always says. So, do we have a habit that you've got a problem with? Then send your thoughts along in an email to
Tom@WPR.org.
No such place.
Zorba@WPR.org. That's the real address.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
You can call us anytime, too, at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show is produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leon Van Sidren. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0330Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.